it's a kind of a funny story, but this is, you know, this is how we work. I wrote to him, I reached out to him. Hello, Dr. Dale, this is Rachel from Amendo. We are interested in working with you. We are developing a program in neutropenia. And he never responded. So I tried again and followed up again, but he never responded. And I wanted to work with him because, you know, he was the right group to work with. So at some point I looked him up and I saw that there's a conference that he was giving a lecture that was pre-corona. I went on an airplane that very evening. I came to the conference the next day and I just, you know, I told him, hi, Dr. Dale, I'm Rachel from Amendo. Can we talk? So, so we talked and now he's, you know, giving a lecture at ASH on the results of this collaboration.
Hi there, welcome back for another Macademia podcast episode. Myself, Ofer Izal Barnea and Elena Itzkovich get together with fascinating people to explore different ways science and scientific careers can be developed outside of academia. Before we introduce our guest for today, we want to thank you, yeah, you, that join our Macademia group on Facebook, follow our account at MacademiaP on Twitter, rated our little project, liked our work, or shared it with a friend or colleague. This, aside from motivating us, support others to join this important conversation as we explore those very different ways of how science is much more than just academia. Good morning, Rachel, and good morning, Elena.
Hi, good morning, Ofer. How are you this morning?
I'm okay. I can't complain, but I don't think anyone cares, but...
Hi, Rachel. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Elena. Great to be here.
So, Rachel, from our preliminary talk, you hold many positions in the most exciting biotech startup. It's not a startup anymore. It is a startup. It's an up-and-coming big pharma, okay? Called Amendo Bio. Rachel, the floor is yours. Give us your elevator pitch. Who are you?
Who am I? I'm a serial entrepreneur in biotech. I've started several companies with a group of good friends that we worked together for many years now. Prior to that, I was working in the field of IP, so I have a lot of experience in constructing intellectual property portfolios for biotech and also for medical device companies. And before that, education. So I did engineering in the Technion and after that, master degree in the Weizmann Institute. I love science very much. It is fascinating. That's my passion. And I love constructing things. I think I love the creative process of generating a company. I love teamwork and working with great people. So I'm really enjoying what I'm doing. And that's me.
So which positions do you hold in Amendo Bio?
So right now I'm a chief business officer, which means that I'm in charge of all the business transactions, all our connections with biotech and other groups in the space. I'm also in charge of the IP portfolio, so overseeing our IP strategy and managing the IP space, which is complex in this field. And also I'm in charge of the pipeline development. So really constructing our clinical pipeline, choosing the right indications to work on. These three areas I'm in charge of, which is a lot of work, but I have teams for all of these different areas. So, yeah.
Well, just from the get-go, I have like so many points I want to touch upon all through this conversation, but maybe let's go to the very beginning. You mentioned your education in academic education, a bachelor's degree in engineering in the Weizmann Institute, and then a science degree in the Weizmann Institute, right? Sorry, in the Technion, yeah. For the bachelor's degree, and the Weizmann Institute for the master's. and you love science. So what was very appealing when you're done with your master's to go at non-academic route?
So I think it took some time for me to really realize what I love. I don't think I would give you the same answer when I went out of the Weizmann Institute. I was always intrigued by science and life sciences. I come from a home that's very, you know, biology and medical oriented. So for me, it was very obvious that I'll go in this direction. But I have to say that, you know, in the Weizmann Institute, I didn't really find myself so much. I didn't know what was interesting for me. And so after the Weizmann Institute, I started working in the field of IP, of intellectual property. Kind of incidentally, I didn't know what I was going into, but when I did, my first work was in the Sheba Medical Center. So they were just beginning the technology transfer office over there. It was early on. And I was looking for a job. And so they were looking for people without necessarily background. So I studied I was first exposed to this field through my work at the Sheba Medical Center. And I've quickly realized that, first of all, it is fascinating. It seems like patents and intellectual property are like technical or legal, but it is actually a fascinating field, because if you look at strategy and you start understanding how patents on one hand are, you know, crucial tool for companies, that's their major assets. The entire value of the company lies in its intellectual property portfolio. But on the other hand, it's a business tool. So it has to be constructed very carefully to generate value. And you have to understand this, you have to understand what you're doing in IP. It is, I've come to realize quite early that companies often fail when they construct intellectual property portfolio, because they don't ask the right questions. So it is really a business tool, and it has to be about that. It has to be about the product, and people often confuse technology with the product. So they go to the patent attorney and they say, okay, this is the technology I've invented. But if you don't focus the discussion on what is the product and what are you really selling and to whom, then you don't get a valuable portfolio. So that was really interesting to understand for me. And I think to this very day, this crosstalk between intellectual property and business is a strength, is something that I bring to the discussion that's always very, very valuable and helpful. So it was fascinating for me to study this field and to realize that there's a huge gap in the way things are constructed, IP is constructed in companies, and to realize that I have a lot of value to bring to this type of discussion. So at some point I started working independent. So I was working as a consultant.
Wait, I want to stop you because you mentioned something very important. You have a lot of value to bring into the process. Okay. What do you mean by that? That is a point that really is very elusive to most people who are in their academic training and thinking what they're going to do next. What is the value I'm going to bring to a process that I've never done before? I have no idea how it works.
For me, it was always about, you know, I love to understand things to bring value. That was always my drive, to bring added value, to bring this something that was not there before, that could change the picture, that could and this was something that was driving me. And learning the field of IP, when I realized that there's this gap in understanding and that you can write patents that will not protect anything and will have no value when it comes to transactions and when it comes to enforcing them, for example. So this is something that drove me to start working as a consultant, because in patents, it's also, you know, the part of the problem is that you can't fix it. Once you've written a patent and it gets published, it's unfixable. You can't change the text. You can't add things in. And it often will generate problems for you in your next filing. So if you haven't written it carefully and you've disclosed things you shouldn't, or if you didn't add in enough data to support what you're doing, so the next filing will be more difficult. So it's really hard to fix once you've filed those patents. So you have to do a very careful job. And for me, I think the motivation was really to help biotech companies do a better job in writing their patents and constructing them correctly to generate value. And it's really not that complicated. You just have to ask the right questions. That's just really goes down to that. So what is really the product?
I think the problem is that a lot of the times the patents come out of research, out of academic research, and they don't know what the product is, right? They found something interesting, and there's a very long way from where they are to the product. So what do you advise in those situations, to sit down and think of a product before you apply for a patent? Or?
Absolutely. This is crucial. You have to think a product. What will be the product? Will it be cell therapy? What's going to be inside the tube? Is it DNA? Is it RNA? Is it encapsulated? How is it given? How is it administered? So I advise people first to go to the field and see what the products look like for other companies who are doing similar things. What's in the vial? What are you injecting into people? Or if it's a device, what are you selling? I think an example that really highlights this situation. So for example, in glucose sensors, that's a company I was involved in. All the technology is in the sensor. So in the sensor itself, you have a lot of technology, and people write patents on the technology in the sensor. But the sensor, they're actually giving away for free. And the entire business model of these companies relies on the test strips, which are, it's a one-time use, and you use a new test strip each time you want to test your blood sugar. But there's no technology there, so there's no patents. And this generates a situation where all the patents are written on something that actually doesn't get sold. So for these type of companies, it's a huge problem, because if you generate another test strip that could match your device, then, and I sell it a little cheaper, then you cannot enforce your patent against me. So this is, and that's a real life example.
So I wonder, like, you working early on in your career with in Shiba, with clinicians coming up with technology or procedures or stuff that they can patent, but their career is dependent on publication, which is the yin to the yang to patents, right? So right. How do you convince them to hold off, or like balance between, wait, with this publication, the patent is much better because we can do something? How you convince clinicians, scientists, academics about that?
So in academic institutions, I think you have to be very respectful of the science. And we were in the technology transfer unit, we're always very respectful of the science and publication. That definitely comes first. And I would never hold a publication for commercial reasons. The patents it could be, but you can always file a patent just before publication. So you just file it and you try to envision everything that could be done, the commercial embodiments, we call it. So what would be the commercial embodiments? So you can write all the different options in the patent. You can write cell therapy, RNA therapy, plasmid, So you can try to envision all the different ways that this invention could turn into a product. And then you just write all the different options in the patent. I think that's part of making a good patent, is try to envision all the different ways that the invention could be embodied into a commercial composition, and then just write it. Just write all the options.
Yeah. And you don't have to prove it, right? You have to imagine it and describe it, but you don't have to actually show that that's how it works or will work.
So really, in patents, data is what matters. This has to be, if you want to get a good patent, you have to support it with data, and you have to support your commercial embodiment with data. So, but you have 1 year to do that. So you can file a patent, a preliminary patent called provisional application. And then you have 1 year to add supporting data. But supporting data is so, so important. You will never get a good, strong, enforceable patent if you don't have an enabling data. And I agree with you that this is part of the tension always between the patent people and the R&D in a company, or the researchers in academic institution, is about the data, what type of data. So definitely there's a tension there. I would want, for example, to support a good patent, I would want a data that supports all cell types. So for example, if I say cancer, I would want data on cell lines that are from different cancers. So show me that it works on cell lines from kidney cancer, from skin cancer, from brain cancer. But for researchers, they don't want to generate this type of data. They have one system, they're working on one system. It's an essay, it's already in the lab, it's working.
It's working.
So you're not going to start doing all different kinds of cell lines just to support broad scope of claims in a patent. So definitely there's tension there between the type of data that I would want from the researcher and the type of data that they usually generate.
Very interesting. So let's move on. So you turn to consulting with all of your very valuable information you gathered. How did you decide to start a company?
So working on IP strategy with different groups and different researchers, also medical device and biotech. And then I started actually working with friends from the Weizmann Institute, good friends that I know from school. And my good friend, my best friend, David Baram, we were friends from the first day of the Weizmann Institute. But after school, we went our own ways. And then at some point, when we started working together, he started working as an entrepreneur. And I came from the world of IP, which was, you know, very synergistic. And we started working together. And he's a relentless entrepreneur. And I just, you know, I joined this journey. And we've gathered other people, other great people that we met on the way. And we started, you know, different companies. So this is how I came into the world of entrepreneurship. David and I, we work together now for over 10 years together on different projects. And he's a brilliant businessman. He's a brilliant scientist. He's a wonderful person, and he's really my very best friend. And so it's been great to work together. It's just been fantastic. This is really a privilege for me to work with so closely with wonderful person like him. We also brought on board Lior Izhar, who came from postdoc in Harvard. We brought him on board as soon as he finished his postdoc. And
So you're all scientists. Do you have someone sort of that took over the business side, or you just all pitched in?
So David is he's as a CEO of the company, he was always in charge of the funding, and he funded several companies I think he raised hundreds of millions of dollars so far. And he's really great at doing that. And also navigating the business of the company. But also early on, again, from this intersection of IP and business, a lot of the business opportunities we've generated actually come from the world of IP. When you need to maybe circumvent some patents or just find opportunities where, you know, the science we're doing or the products we're developing can help or can generate opportunities that come from the world of patents. So the crosstalk between patents and science and business is generating a lot of opportunities for the company.
That's very interesting. So let's talk about the MendoBio. Sure. Can you tell us a little bit what it is, how it started?
So MendoBio started so maybe a little history before that. Mm-hmm. David did his PhD at Ada Yonath's lab. So he comes from the world of protein structure and function. And we, before Amendo, we were doing a lot of work in protein engineering. We have realized that it is a very powerful methodology to do directed evolution and protein engineering, because you can really take proteins that were evolved in nature in one context and take them to a totally different context by changing them. So you need to evolve them. You need to optimize proteins and improve them if you want them to work in a different context. So for example, if you, again, from the glucose sensing, if you want a protein to do glucose sensing on a test strip, then you may need to change it, to change its properties. Or in the present company in Amendo, we're using CRISPR to do gene editing. So CRISPR was evolved in nature, in bacteria as an immune system. But if you wanted to work in human genomes and do completely different type of work, you need to change them, to optimize them. So protein engineering was our choice in terms of technology, of what we do with this protein, directed evolution mostly. And then we wanted to employ this technology of directed evolution in gene editing, because we felt, you know, it was quite early. We started 2016. So CRISPR, on one hand, was already revolutionizing the space, but it was not adjusted well to working in human genomes. So when we started Amendo, we really wanted to take CRISPR to the next level, to what we call next generation CRISPR. And that's what we're doing. So we're actually evolving these proteins. We're doing directed evolution, large libraries of protein variants that we introduce mutations to the sequence. We do that by both rational design, but also random mutagenesis. And then we screen these very large libraries, like 10 in the 9 variants, and we screen them to get the best results for what we want the protein to do. So this is how we started. We took Lior Izar, as I told you, just came back from Harvard from his postdoc. He comes from the world of DNA repair and DNA damage response. So the genomic context was more his contribution. David and I came from protein engineering. So this is how Amendo started, by combining these two methodologies or fields.
So was he working in sort of this directed evolution? So how did you know it's going to work the way you envision it?
At first we didn't. There are some proteins that are more amenable for protein engineering, and some proteins are less. There was some work done in the field already in introducing different mutations to CRISPR for all types of reasons. And so it seemed like it's going to be a good candidate for that, but we had to test that. So we were very fortunate to be in a position where we could get funded. Very seed investment was from OrbiMed, which is a it's an investment. It's a investment fund in early biotech, and so they were our first investors. So we started with a concept and a motivation and some money, and we started working. So, you know, we were four people at the beginning. Today we are 100.
Wow. In those first pitches, when you were a bunch of scientists with a cool idea, almost a technology looking for an application.
Absolutely.
How did you sell this? How did you convince them that this is worthwhile? We don't know exactly what it's going to solve. We have a hunch, but it's worthwhile.
So at the time, CRISPR was so hot that we didn't have to say a lot. We said CRISPR, we said optimization and directed evolution, and that's all we had to say.
Bitcoin.
So they were, they were on from the very beginning. So if you work in fields that are really happening in biotech, and gene editing was, you know, it still is a very hot area in the field. So it's not so hard to raise money for this. Everyone sees the opportunity. And I think it was obvious. So we didn't have to work very hard to pitch it to get funded at first. But you do need to generate your, you know, what do you do different? What is your differentiation? And where do you want to go? Where do you want to take this? So for us, it was about making CRISPR very safe and making it very efficient. Because, you know, off-target in CRISPR is a huge concern if you don't want to do off-target cuts in the genome. So specificity is the major, major issue in safety of CRISPR. And that was our very first goal. So to make CRISPR very specific. So just on target and no off target at all. And this is something that we use directed evolution to achieve. And it proved itself to be very, very, you know, it was the right choice to do, because now we can make CRISPR extremely specific in a manner that I haven't seen any parallel to that.
In any system?
So this is it's a good question. So we optimize CRISPR pair targets, pair systems. So it really depends on the context, on the type of cells that you want to use, on your target site. So it's always guide specific. You have to optimize it. So when we do directed evolution and we do rounds of selection for the libraries of variants, we do that using the specific guide we'll be using and in the specific cell context that we'll be working in. So it has to be optimized pair targets.
So taking you back to IP strategy. So what is the IP strategy on that? So what exactly in this process are you patenting?
So so we're actually patenting several things. So first of all, we are patenting the variants. So it's a composition. So we're generating a composition for a specific disease, right? So we're patenting the variant, the protein variant that was most successful. We're patenting the guides, which is key in this area. So guides, you know, at the end of the day, you have, you know, not a huge amount of guides. You want to target a specific cut site, you have only the guides around that site. So guides are definitely something that's...
So this, you mean the sequence, right? So you patent the specific sequence that you'll be using?
So guide has two parts. It has the part that targets the genome, and it has another part that binds to the protein. So it's 100 base pair, around 100 bases, not base pair, sorry, it's bases, it's single strand RNA moiety that you can patent, and you patent the guides. You know, the sequence and the sequence that targets the genome is around 20 bases. And you would think it's a natural sequence of the human genome, but you patent it as in the context of an RNA guide binding CRISPR protein as a composition for curing a specific disease. So when you take it out of its natural context, it becomes a patentable composition.
Interesting.
A very important point.
And in addition, we have, and that's another very important part of what we do right now, is to generate additional CRISPR nucleases. So we screen the space. And this is actually a good example for the crosstalk for MIP, because, you know, there are challenges in the IP space around CRISPR. So originally, the motivation to find novel CRISPR nucleases was around IP, because the, you know, SpCas9 is heavily patented, and we felt like, you know, we can't just use SpCas9; it's a dead end in terms of IP. So we went to look for additional nucleases, and now we have a very extensive program at Amendo for discovery of novel nucleases. So we, you know, scan the space of bacteria, which is broad and immense. And we just, it's very complicated. We have, we've become very good at it. So we can find novel nucleases. You need to discover the PAM site. You need to discover the scaffold, the guide. So there's a lot of discovery work. We have an extensive bioinformatic unit, which does a lot of predictions, a lot of analysis. So we discover novel nucleases. So originally the motivation was IP, but we've discovered very fast that it is also provides us with a lot of novel characteristics for these nucleases. So some of them are short, some of them are long, some of them are highly specific, some of them are very active. So these different properties, and also various PAM sites, which is also very useful for what we need to do. So these different properties of the nucleases also provided a lot of opportunities for Amendo. Again, from the IP world, we can also license out nucleases, because the entire industry is looking at novel nucleases that are not under hundreds of different patents. So a lot of our collaborations are also around licensing out our novel nucleases. So IP business, it's always an intersection, and science, of course.
So you just answered my next question exactly about that. But what happened if you screen so much? You must find stuff that are out of the business scope of Amendo. So what do you do with that? So just answer that. So it's quite, I think it's quite beautiful, and it's something that is like, I think it deconflict a lot of the like worries that academics had about no working in the industry is like just for profit. You never collaborate. You never share stuff. No, and see, you do share stuff. What you describe now really explain to me your second role as head of pipeline, because it's very natural that you have dealt with that aspect of the work and science of Amendo, and you came up with you have all the data in your hand, and you can see what is patentable and what it's not, and what you can take into the pipeline and decide this we should pursue and this we should pursue afterwards or not, or license out. So what is head of pipeline, and what is a pipeline in a CRISPR development company?
So pipeline is first of all, it's a crucial part of developing a company, and it's actually the most interesting part of my job, is to find the right indications to work on. This is very complicated, and you have to take into account hundreds of different considerations when you choose indications. And also, once you choose an indication, you're very much committed to it. You have investors, you're investing in a program, you start to generate collaborations around it. So it has to be selected very, very carefully. And so generating a pipeline. So for example, for Amendo, as I told you, we're using directed evolution to increase specificity of the nucleases. And once we could do that, we realized that we can actually take on the next challenge in specificity, because eliminating off targets, that's of course necessary and very important. But then again, we saw that we can make CRISPR nucleases so specific that we can actually differentiate between alleles based on a single mismatch. And that allowed us, you know, at that point, I realized that for the purposes of pipeline, let's take on this challenge of going after dominant indications, dominant diseases. This is something that no other company took on, because for dominant indications, maybe a little brief on genetics. So for recessive diseases, you have two alleles that are that have a loss of function mutation. But in dominant indications, you have one allele that's mutated, but the other allele is actually healthy. So for dominant indications, there's one mutation, one mutated allele causing a disease. And another way to call this type of diseases is toxic gain of function. So you want to actually knock out a single allele and leave the other one intact. And this is something that when building the pipeline, It also, first of all, it's a huge field that no one took on so far. So this is like a world of diseases that were not touched upon in any other CRISPR company. But it could also really highlight the power of our technology. So the fact that we could get to such high level of specificity, we could actually take on this challenge of editing one allele over the other, leaving the other one completely intact. And in terms of specificity, this is something which is really the highest bar of specificity for nucleases, because usually when you talk about off targets, that's around three mismatches. And so a single mismatch between the alleles is really the highest bar of specificity for nucleases. So it really helped us build a pipeline that is not, you will not find the diseases we're working on in any other CRISPR company. This generates differentiation, a very strong differentiation. And it also generates a pipeline of indications that we can now do. So we've started scanning the world of dominant negative indications. And then, you know, you start asking, okay, so what are we working on? Hematopoietic cells, liver diseases. So you have to pick a target organ. And this is where delivery comes into play. So delivery is, of course, one of the most challenging aspects of generating pharmaceutical compositions, because, you know, the question is, okay, how do you deliver CRISPR into cells? So we started working on ex vivo indications. That was the first choice, because delivery ex vivo is pretty much established, and you can easily, as much as something in biology can be referred to as easy, but you can deliver composition, CRISPR compositions into hematopoietic stem cells ex vivo. And so that was our first choice, to do ex vivo program in hematopoietic stem cells. So then you start scanning the space for the right indication. So what would be the right indication for that? And again, a lot of consideration, a lot of it has to do with the disease mechanism. Is it clear enough? So a lot of literature to review. And also at Amendo, we have what we call the POC team, the proof of concept department, that I work very closely with. These are scientists who are very creative, and you know, because we do the analysis in silico, and you know, we analyze the literature and we understand the mechanism, and we have geneticists on our team, and we have a lot of people who understand human genetics to great depth. But then you have to do some feasibility study to see that it could actually work. So you have to put in place systems and essays and readouts and to do a feasibility study. So this is, you know, it's a fascinating science to really work on patient-derived cells and to generate CRISPR composition that can specifically target only the mutated allele, leaving the other one intact, and then putting in place all the assays and the readouts required to make sure that we can actually affect the phenotype. So if we edit out the mutated allele, do we change the phenotype? So you have to see the function of these cells. And you're working in a very clear clinical context on that. So in terms of science, I think it doesn't get more interesting than that.
Yeah, it sounds like a very diverse group of scientists, right? Because you start from a very, very basic biology of screening for nucleases up until disease. And I guess, how far do you get? Do you start clinical trials or?
So we're going to go first in man next year. We're very excited. We're putting our first program, which is most advanced, is in severe congenital neutropenia. This is a disease. This is a dominant negative disease, a toxic gain of function that affects neutrophil differentiation. So when you have this mutation, it's a gene called ELANE. And when you have a toxic gain of function mutation in ELANE, actually, hematopoietic stem cells cannot differentiate normally into neutrophils. So these children have very, very low count of neutrophils, sometimes zero. So they're very exposed to infections. And what we actually do is we edit out, we knock out the mutated allele. We leave only the healthy one intact and we restore function of neutrophils. And now we have done that on cells from patients, so from several different patients. We are working on this program in collaboration with University of Washington, a very strong group in UW with Dr. David Dale. And now we are also starting clinical studies, preclinical and going clinical with Seattle Children's Hospital, again, with a very strong group over there. So part of the pipeline development for me was to also find the right groups to work with. So it was, when I identified Dr. Dale's group in UW, I knew we have to work with them. They have all the resources required in terms of the patient foundation and access to patient samples. So we actually, it's a kind of a funny story, but this is, you know, this is how we work. I wrote to him, I reached out to him. Hello, Dr. Dale, this is Rachel from Amendo. We are interested in working with you. We are developing a program in neutropenia. And he never responded. So I tried again and followed up again, but he never responded. And I wanted to work with him because, you know, he was the right group to work with. So at some point I looked him up and I saw that there's a conference that he was giving a lecture that was pre-corona. I went on an airplane that very evening. I came to the conference the next day and I just, you know, I told him, "Hi, Dr. Dale, I'm Rachel from Amendo. Can we talk?" So, so we talked and, now he's, you know, giving a lecture at ASH on the results of this, collaboration.
Did he tell you why he didn't respond to the email?
No, he didn't. He was kind of shocked to see me, but you know, we have to be Israelis at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Fantastic. So yeah, everyone there, I think there are a lot of frustration with people not answering emails in the US. So that's one approach. Yeah. Hop on the airplane.
Today, fantastic. Less, but yeah,
today list. Yeah.
Some find someone in a close by office, Zoom link him, and just go with him.
So it sounds very collaborative, and
it
is.
I want to ask. So it sounds very promising, and and working on something with an impact. And it comes a lot when we talk to people in biotech, in drug development, that they're very close to the bedside. It's not the ivory tower kind of feeling in the academia. It's very close by. And I was contacted by a company here for a position, and in their job description, the first thing they offer as benefit is patient days. And they work on ultra rare disease, and they said this is a key thing for us. So how it works also works in Emendo. So you meet the patients, you meet the people behind the condition.
Yes, actually, the conference that I went to meet Dr. Dale was a patient conference. So it was patients and their families, and I got to meet these children who have to inject to themselves every day. They had injection parties in the during the conference for the children. I was talking to the patients to really understand what they're going through, how's their life, daily life, how they manage the disease. I heard about their childhood, mostly in hospitals. So yes, definitely. We're trying to really understand the disease also from the patient perspective. It's all about the patients. The physicians working are all about the patients. You know, I was really very impressed to see it's not cynical. It's not, it's really about the patients. The physicians care a lot.
No, it's incredible to start from an idea, a very basic biology idea where, okay, I'm going to make CRISPR better, and go all the way to, you know, these are the kids that I can help and make their lives so much better. I think it's fantastic. And I think it's fantastic that this collaborative spirit really allows you to move so fast, because, you know, if you were at academia, you're sort of stuck at some level of this discovery process. And here you have this sort of the leverage of sort of combining everything together. And it's very exciting.
For sure. I think maybe one of the differences, this is a very important point, I think. One of the differences between research in industry and academia is that we have to think all the way. We have to think about a composition, a pharmaceutical composition that will go into patients. So I cannot work in systems that are not translatable to people. And in academia, often they use systems that are not translatable, that are not applicable. So and I think this is one of the major, major differences. I'm not going to go and work in a system just because I can show some effect if the system is a dead end for me, if it's not translatable. So I have to think all the way through to the patient, to the way the composition is going to go into people. And this is something that drives the way we work, because we have to, because we're actually developing compositions for humans.
So you're not doing CRISPR screens in yeast.
Exactly. Exactly. We can maybe screen, you know, when we're screening, we can start with very large, with very high throughput screening in a bacterial system. That would be our first screening step. But then we will move to human cells, and then we will move to primary cells. And, you know, we can't stop in bacteria because it's irrelevant. We have to test it in not just human cell line, but also primary target cells that we're going to be using. So it has to be very, very relevant to the actual system it will be done on.
I want to maybe ask a tough question, and you can say it's out of the scope, but Emendo Bio is an Israeli company. You start in the Israeli ecosystem, but your collaborators are clearly in the US. in one of the major hubs. So Seattle, Boston, San Francisco, San Diego, all of those, Houston. I'm thinking Silicon Valley and not biotech. What is the added value of like an Israeli company coming with this CRISPR solution? And you've said yourself, there are several other companies with Nobel laureates here in the Silicon Valley, for example, that works on similar technology, not exactly the same, but similar. So what is the added value of like an Israeli company?
So from my experience with working with the US, I think we're thinking very differently. And this could, joining forces from Israel and US could be extremely synergistic and fruitful. I find that in the US, they're thinking a lot about process. And in Israel, we're not very good at processes, but we are very, very good at content. We are very creative. We have, I don't think anyone's comparable in that aspect of generating very creative and very well-designed content and solutions. So if you join these two thinking ways together, it could really turn great. It could sometimes collide. But yes, it's I think we bring to the table something that's very special as Israelis. Even this type of you know, just going there and shaking his hand, hi Dr. Dale, you know, I'm Rachel from Amendo. This is something that that's very Israeli. But also the way we're generating, you know, our science, we're generating our programs, we're generating delivery methodologies. We are very fast. We work very fast. We just we keep pushing forward all the time. Really, it's like which is fun because biology takes ages. Everything takes so much time, and unless you push forward very fast, you're not gonna get anything done. You know,
it's actually a question I have a lot of the times is like, how do you push on biology? Like, how do you do that? Because if cells, you know, if it takes them, I don't know, 2 weeks to differentiate to the type of cell that you want to work on, you can't push it. It's going to take them 14 days.
Definitely. That's that's frustrating. But when I say push, it means that, you know, we consider lead time for example, for ordering guides, which is long, which is like 6 to 8 weeks. So we all the time think ahead of ordering things in time. So we don't wait for things, you know, for reagents to come. The minute they come, everything is ready for the experiments to start. We are doing things in parallel. So if something fails, you always have a backup. We think ahead in terms of, for example, delivery. So if I have a specific delivery for, let's say I'm using viral delivery for CNS, then I will go to the very beginning to develop my composition that will be suitable for viral delivery for that purpose. So we're very efficient because we're thinking all the way through and we're taking the downstream into the upstream. So you don't waste time on all kinds of directions that are irrelevant. And we have to plan very carefully. And sometimes you order things at risk. You know, we can't wait even for the results of the first experiment. So we already order reagents for different outcomes that could be for that experiment because we want to be ready with the next step. So, you know, we find the ways to work very efficiently. But no, you cannot shorten essays. If I could, I would.
So you grew the company. You were part of the growing team of this company from like four people with an idea to over 100 now?
Yes.
What is the hardest position to hire for?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I'm trying to build myself an employment niche.
So I think, I don't know, you know, experimental biologists who are very creative and flexible in their thinking, who have deep understanding of biology, who are leaders in terms of their personal capabilities, who are very optimistic and relentless. And so I think we were able to really gather at Amenjo a phenomenal group of people. It's it's hard to really explain the team spirit and the that we have at Amenjo and the care. A lot of it's really just an amazing place to work. The atmosphere is amazing. It's all very exciting. The work is exciting. Everyone's around. Everyone's so committed to what they're doing. And I think it starts from the management. It really starts from the CEO. He cares about the people. He really, really important to him to have everyone find their right place where they're most valuable, where they express themselves, where they get to be the best that they can. And so this is the type of people we're looking for. It's not easy to hire people. We put a lot of effort and a lot of resources into hiring the right people to the right positions. But I think it's key. It's a major key. It's a major, major key for success of the company to have really great people who are committed who are optimistic.
what would you consider as like under the headline of leadership? What like you put into this box in a candidate coming out of academia, no industry experience whatsoever? So what could I or anyone else, not me, okay, I'm not looking for a job,
could put in my CV? We are hiring, just saying.
We are half a word away. So what can I put in my CV that indicate that I have leadership potential, but have no experience in industry?
Yeah. So I think leadership is a lot about, first of all, being able to teamwork and team spirit, being supportive of other people, bringing, I said optimism, you know, it's really key, because if you insist of something that will, it depends on this attitude where you're coming, that it's going to work, that will make it work, that I'll help my team members make it work. So I think these type of properties, as well as management, is something that is tricky. You know, when we see scientists taking managerial positions, it's not a trivial transition to do. It's you suddenly are, you know, you're required to do other things, to manage people. It's a whole different story than doing science or good science. And this transition is something that proved to be sometimes challenging for people. And you can't really tell in advance, but it's, you know, it's really about taking responsibility and caring for your team and caring for the results that you're supplying, caring for the type of atmosphere you're generating in the team. Just being responsible, just, you know, taking responsibility for the things you're doing and for the people you're managing. It's a lot of personal skills, but we also invest in that as well. So the company is investing in developing managers and helping them do a better job. It's very, very important.
Sounds like a empowering place. So
yeah.
It is. That's great. Rachel, I want to thank you so much for your time. We had some issues scheduling, but I'm so happy this worked out. And I'm in Dubai. It sounds like an amazing place. And obviously you have such a huge role in making it what it is.
Thank you. So,
thank you. Thank you so much. And good luck. It sounds like a very important goal you have there.
Thank you.
Thank you for this conversation. Thank you very much.